someone else's journey is our lesson.
We used to say, the difficult we do immediately, the impossible just takes a little more time.
Someone else's lesson is our gift.
I believe part of our responsibility is really to equip and inspire our students to ask those difficult questions.
Be encouraged by the stories that lift us all.
I came to Howard because I wanted to be the President of the United States.
Somebody saw something in me, and it's my duty to be that person for somebody else.
Now, join Dr. Wayne Frederick, President of Howard University, and his guest on The Journey.
Getting to know a man helps to understand his perspective. On this edition of The Journey, we continue a conversation we began with one who has spent his life pushing the envelope. He has been at the center of tough issues and has not shied away from hard questions. He has raised challenging ideas that speak to our times and to our ongoing national debate on race and relationships with law enforcement. This year, he holds an endowed chair in public policy at Howard University. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick, and today on The Journey, we join a conversation already in progress with the 7th Director of the FBI, Mr. James Comey. Welcome.
Great to be here, Dr. Frederick.
One obvious thing and one obvious reason being here at Howard is the issue of law enforcement and race and how those two intersect. How do you get law enforcement to do what they have to do without prejudicial treatment of an entire community just based on the color of someone's skin or the zip code on their driver's license? And what are your thoughts about that as you went about not just being a prosecutor, but then also leading the FBI?
Yeah, it's an issue that has been part of my professional life throughout it. In fact, I believe, and I told the whole FBI this when I was there, I think race is the central narrative of American life. And our country, as I told the whole FBI, was born in original sin. Despite the words of our declaration, human beings were in slavery when we were born. And so dealing with that, overcoming that original sin, changing America has been the mission of this country since its founding. And law enforcement has been a huge part of enforcing whatever the status quo was, and often very, very brutal on people of color, especially black people. And so it was a feature of law enforcement from the moment I joined it. But the more I became involved in communities of color, especially when I moved to be a federal prosecutor in Richmond, the more I came to see the divide often between those communities and the people who thought they were there to serve and protect that community. And so how to navigate that divide was at the center of my work when I was a line prosecutor in Richmond, when I was the U.S. attorney back in New York, when I was a senior, the number two at the Department of Justice. And then I was lucky enough to become the FBI director and decided we needed to stare at our history. Given the importance of race and law enforcement and closing the divide, one of the things I tried to do first at the FBI was stare at the history of the FBI in interacting, especially with the black community in America. And then at the same time, about a year later, Ferguson happened. Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, followed by a series of very, very high-profile uses of deadly force by law enforcement against people of color. And the country, in a way, joined a conversation that people in law enforcement and people of color had long been involved in, which is, how do we protect in a way that is lawful and appropriate and respectful, and how do we close the gap? I expected to focus on race and diversity at the FBI, given its history, given its need to attract people of different backgrounds. Then the FBI, by virtue of what was going on in the country in 2014 and after, became part of the national conversation where I tried to be useful.
And what are some of the things that you did while at the FBI to try to promote that understanding, close that gap, and to help with the diversity at the FBI?
Well, the first thing I did was say, we have to be honest with ourselves about where we have been. So I ordered the creation of a course at the FBI that's still ongoing, where every new analyst and every new agent study the history of the FBI's interaction with civil rights leadership in the 1950s and 60s, but especially Dr. Martin Luther King. And it's an ugly and painful history, but I wanted it studied. And I wanted to stimulate thinking. I didn't want to instruct people on how you should think about those important issues. So I required that the course be one that would make thoughtful people understand the history and then think for themselves what it should mean to them. So that course involved studying that history and then required all of its graduates, before they could finish the course, to come to Washington, visit the King Memorial, take one of the great expressions of Dr. King's that are chiseled into the wall in that impressive memorial, and then write an essay about how that those words of Dr. King intersect with the FBI's values. We're not going to tell you what to think. We want you to think knowing the history. So that's the first thing I did. Second thing I did was I said, I'm going to make diversity one of the FBI's core values. I believe it should be and has been one of its core values, but I'm going to call it out because I want conversation about diversity. And then the third thing I did was something a little bit more low-key and symbolic, but you know this, as the president of a great university, everybody watches what you do and they talk about you, sometimes I guess in great ways, sometimes in less great ways. With you, I'm sure it's all great ways. But I knew as director, people would gossip about me. And so I did something that I wanted to be the object of gossip. I took a single sheet of paper, which was the October 1963 memorandum from J. Edgar Hoover to Robert F. Kennedy, who was then the Attorney General. Hoover was the FBI director, asking for permission to bug and wiretap Martin Luther King. And it's a single sheet of paper, five sentences long. It's really without substance. It doesn't make any kind of factual showing. There's no date restriction, no time restriction. It just says, there's a communist influence in the racial situation. We need to bug this guy. And it's signed by J. Edgar Hoover, and then it's approved by Robert F. Kennedy, and then the FBI was off to the races. Again, no restriction, no oversight, no check, no balance. I took that sheet of paper, and I put it under the glass on the right side of my desk, this big old desk. And I put it there because that's the spot where every morning I would review requests the FBI was going to make to wiretap or bug people in our national security cases. And I would put there every morning this huge stack of applications that are thicker than my wrist. It's a pain in the neck to get permission to bug or wiretap somebody in the United States, and it should be. And what I liked about the thickness of those applications and the personal requirement that I sign them is that's oversight, that's constraint, that's check, that's balance. And I liked that I could put it on top of the single sheet of paper that reflected the absence of those things. But I also put it there because I knew that people would hear about the director's sheet of paper and ask about it and talk about it. And it would feed my hope that people would be transparent about our history and then forward-looking about what we should do in light of that history. And it worked. It generated lots of conversation, lots of interest. Probably one other thing I should mention, I established for the first time a section in the FBI devoted just to our diversity and inclusion initiatives because I wanted people waking up every day thinking, how do we make the FBI better? Because we faced a crisis at the FBI. When I got there, 83% of our special agents were white. I got no problem with white people. But it had been getting steadily and steadily and steadily more white, the cohort of special agents. And that's a path to a very dangerous situation. Because at some point, the FBI will become viewed as a place where white people work. And then 83% will become 100%. And we will be less effective for the country. We'll be less smart. We'll make poorer decisions. We'll be unable to connect with communities in the way we need to. And so I spoke explicitly about that. And I wrote to the whole organization. I used to email them myself and say, this is about effectiveness. There is a danger, a threat to the FBI's effectiveness. Our challenge, the talent is out there. Our challenge is to get out there and tell that talent, you should try making a life here. You're not getting paid much money, but you can make a difference in communities you care about by joining this workforce. And I was FBI director for about 4 years. Change had already started. And I'm an optimist. I believe the change, I wish I was still at the FBI, but I believe the change has a momentum that will continue, and great people of all backgrounds will continue to come to that organization.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Mr. James Comey. He is the 2017-2018 Gwendolyn S. and Colbert I. King Endowed Chair and Public Policy Holder at Howard University. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Now, obviously, the FBI, like many institutions in our country, are complex organizations with complex histories. And when you look at those complex histories, we as leaders inherit the good and the bad in those histories. And we have to try to either make a pivot based on what we believe in. And obviously, in your circumstance, one of the pivots you wanted to make was a pivot that had more diversity and inclusion. But having said that, the FBI still had a history that you inherited. And how do you advise folks like myself with complex organizations, with mixed histories, how do you make that pivot?
The answer to me is transparency and humility. First, by being honest about where you have been, what the history actually is, and talking about it in an open way. And the humility piece is recognizing that you may not fully understand how people encounter that history and how they engage with it. And so the first thing you need to do is share the history and then shut up and listen to people and hear their perspectives on that history and also how you're dealing with it. And to do that in a way that is up close. I believe it's hard to hate up close. And it's easy to categorize people at a distance and to put people into boxes. But when you get in a room with people and say, look, this is who I am, and this is what I believe, and this is what I'm trying to accomplish, it's very hard for people to avoid engaging on that. Most people want to, when they get to know a human being, connect with them in a decent way. And so be transparent, approach the subject with humility, and try to get up close with people as often as possible. And talk honestly about what you're trying to do. And then when people point out things that you're trying to do that don't make sense to them, listen to them. And if they're right, change the way you're approaching it. I find that that combination of transparency, humility, and up-closeness becomes irresistible to people. So that's how I think about it.
You and your wife have participated in foster care for quite some time. What about foster care drew both you and your wife, and what is your perspective about foster care, the state of foster care in our nation today?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was drawn there because I married up, and so I married an amazing woman. I have a commitment to public service. A lot of it I inherited from her. I went to law school. She went in the Peace Corps to West Africa after graduation, and luckily she allowed me to continue to chase her and married me. It was her belief that there are that we are extraordinarily fortunate. We are privileged by virtue of who we are, where we were born, the opportunities we've had. And so our obligation is to try and find ways to, not to deny that or feel guilty about that, but to say, look, I have these opportunities to contribute. How can I contribute, first? Second, we thought it'd be really good for our kids. They've grown up in an intact family with all kinds of advantages, and there's a danger there. You can grow up in a bubble and not realize the challenges that other people face. And then third is a crying need. One of the things we don't talk about a whole lot in this country is just how many children need support and need the guidance and protection of foster care. And there's a shirt, actually, that we gave to all the kids that we got from a foster care organization. There's that the milk industry had a Got Milk promotion. It just says Got Love and question mark. So many kids need that love, and it's so much easier than people think. And so that combination of things led us to it, and it was It delivered on all of those fronts. It was great for us because we were able to help children. It was great for our kids because they could see the difference in other American lives from their own. And we hope that it inspired friends and family and others to try and do it as well. We picked emergency foster care and newborn because we learned that that was a real need in the foster care system, because most foster care parents, both parents are working, so it's hard to care for a newborn. And my wife was home with the kids, so she said she can do this. And so one of the foster children we got was a boy who was born to a drug-addicted mother, premature, came to us a tiny, tiny infant. And so Patrice had the ability to sleep with that little boy on her chest every night for months so he could feel the closeness and the attachment. And I know where he is today. We've stayed very close with him, and he is doing extraordinarily well because she was able to give him that so early in his life.
It's absolutely fantastic. Now, as we close, you've been here at Howard University. You've interacted with a wide variety of students, faculty members, etc. Howard University obviously means a lot to me, not just as its 17th president, but also as an alum. What have you seen in the folks that you've interacted with at Howard University since you've been here?
Oh, a lot of great things. Maybe the things that leap most to mind is energy and lack of deference, which I just love. People care passionately about the issues that I care about and want to talk about, and they don't waste time with, well, let me ask you a polite question first, or let me ask you a softball question first. Especially the students, but the faculty as well, go right to the hard questions. And that is exactly what we need. We don't have time in this country to spend a lot of time with diplomacy. We've got hard issues. And the great thing about Howard is the people are extraordinarily bright, and they will come at it directly and engage in a conversation. And already I've accomplished a huge part of my first goal, which is to learn. I don't know how much I've taught, but I have learned a ton, which makes me excited about the rest of the year.
Thanks for being here. My guest today has been Mr. James Comey. He is the 2017-2018 Gwendolyn S. and Colbert I. King Endowed Chair and Public Policy Holder. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne Frederick on the Howard University Radio Network.